On the Murder Squad, we discuss details of crimes that are often violent in nature. Listener discretion is advised.
I'm Billy Jensen.
I'm Paul Holes.
This is the Murder Squad. A young mother's 2-year-old falls sick. After taking her to see the doctor, a fight breaks out between her boyfriend and his parents. The mother calls her family and tells them that she can handle it, doesn't need to be picked up. The next day, she places 2 more phone calls, the first to her aunt and the second to her father.
After those calls, the woman and daughter's whereabouts are based on one person's statements. No witnesses or surveillance can confirm them. The two haven't been seen or heard from since, and now, after 17 years, the woman's younger sister is investigating her disappearance. Our job, to find Jennifer and Adriana Wicks.
This is the Murder Squad.
So was that you? Are you actually drinking a beer?
I am drinking a beer.
It's
3 o'clock.
That's not normal.
That's not normal. I don't know. I just felt like drinking a beer. Yeah. It was a beer left over from the first degree recording session. So.
Ah, okay.
Yes. Okay. So, Paul, we have an update.
Okay.
We covered the disappearance of Morgan Nick in season 2, episode 37. And we recently got an email from a Murder Squad member named Candace, who said, I'm from Arkansas and been listening since the beginning. I was happy y'all covered Morgan Nick. I heard they have an update with a person of interest. I don't think it's a coincidence that the most traction this case has ever had was after your podcast episode. Here's a link to the FBI website and who they are looking into. So we followed that link. Sure enough, the FBI announced on November 9th that they were looking for information of a person of interest related to the case.
Wow.
Now, 6-year-old Morgan disappeared on June 9th, 1995, from a parking lot of the Wolford baseball field in Alma, Arkansas. A man was seen in the parking lot, and they believe they are close to identifying this person. The FBI is looking for any information about a man named Billy Jack Lynx. Lynx was from Crawford County, Arkansas. He served in the U.S. Army during World War II. When he returned, he worked for Braniff Airline in Dallas from 62 to 74, and he came home to Van Buren, Arkansas at some point in the late 70s. Just 2 months after Morgan's abduction, Lynx attempted to abduct a young girl. This abduction was in Van Buren, 8 miles from where Morgan was kidnapped. Now, Billy Jack Lynx died in prison in 2000, but if you knew him or if you're from that area, ask around, ask people that might not listen to the podcast or have any information about him. Please contact us or contact the FBI.
Yeah, they're obviously trying to figure out, you know, is he involved in Morgan's abduction? He's done or attempted to do something similar in the same general area around the same time. Doesn't mean he's necessarily the guy in Morgan's case, but you got to consider him for sure.
Yeah. And also, if you still, we wanted to stress that that doesn't mean the case is solved. If you have information that is not even related to Lynx at all, you should still report it. But this looks like a really solid lead, especially for a case that happened so long ago, and hopefully we'll get some answers.
Yeah. You know, and the FBI is obviously just trying to, you know, cast a wide net for people who knew him to get as much information about Lynx as possible. But now let's go to Robertson County, Tennessee. 21-year-old Jennifer Wicks is the oldest of her mom Kathy's 3 daughters. They were all very close. Her sister Casey described Jennifer as quiet and strong-willed. When Jennifer gave birth to her daughter Adriana in January of 2002, everyone was supportive. The little girl called Kathy Mimi. Adriana's father wasn't in the picture at the time, so Jennifer relied on her family, including extended family like her grandmothers and aunt. This was especially true in early 2003, when Kathy accepted a new job that took her to Las Vegas. Kathy and Jennifer's youngest sister, Casey, moved across the country. Jennifer and her other sister stayed behind with the family in Tennessee. While Kathy was in Vegas, Jennifer met a new boyfriend, Joey Benton. The two had an off-and-on-again relationship. In September of 2003, Kathy received a frantic phone call from Jennifer. She allegedly told her mother that Joey had threatened to harm himself, Jennifer, and Adriana. Jennifer went to stay with her grandmother Wicks after this, but did not file a police report. Kathy decided to move her and Casey back home to Tennessee to be closer to Jennifer. When Kathy got to Tennessee, Jennifer and Adriana moved in with her. At the time, she and Joey were no longer together. This changed sometime in November of 2003, but Kathy made it clear he was not allowed to come into her home. On December 21st, 2003, Joey came to the house. Jennifer decided that she and Adriana were going to move in with Joey. Kathy did not want it to happen. According to Jennifer's sister Casey, arguing ensued. At 15 years old, she took her niece to a back bedroom and called 911. We were able to talk to Casey about that day.
You know, things got physical that day. You know, we were trying to physically stop her from going back with this person who had pulled a gun on them, you know, right before. You know, it wasn't that long after, you know, and my mom knew that his family had, Jennifer had told us, they have a gun in arm's reach no matter where you're at in their home. You know, we're trying to prevent her and the baby from going back into this situation. And we had shut the door whenever, I guess, Joey was taking things out to the car because they were gathering the baby's and her things to take back to his house. And we had shut the door. And when he came back, you know, he heard the fighting and arguing and everything on the inside. I guess my sister and my mom were trying to prevent her from leaving. And that's whenever he kicked down our door. And I called the police and they showed up and took statements. And then at the end of the day, Jennifer came back with the police and with Joey's mom to get the baby.
At this time, Jennifer, Adriana, and Joey lived in what was called the barn on the Benton family's property. Casey says it was more like a shed. There was a bed, a couch, a TV, and a space heater, but didn't have running water. If they wanted to use the bathroom or take a shower, they had to go inside Joey's parents' house. Jennifer told her family that the house had guns and drugs present, but it was still where she wanted to live because she wanted to be with Joey. Jennifer didn't have much contact with her mom and Casey during this time, but she still talked to her aunt and her grandmother. The holidays were spent apart for the sisters, and Mimi wasn't invited to Adriana's second birthday party. Slowly, Jennifer began to have contact with her mom and Casey again. She came by on Casey's birthday in February, and things seemed to slowly be righting themselves until the week Jennifer and Adriana disappeared. Now, a few weeks before, Jennifer, Joey, and Adriana had moved into Joey's parents' home because it wasn't warm enough to stay out in the barn anymore. The house was set up for Joey and Jennifer to have a room, Adriana to have her own room, and then Joey's parents had a bedroom. Jennifer was beginning to sleep train the two-year-old when the two-year-old became sick. On the evening of March 22nd, 2004, Jennifer called her mother, Kathy. Adriana was running a fever and said it hurt to use the bathroom. Kathy told Jennifer to take the baby to the emergency room, but Jennifer didn't have a car, so she had to rely on Joey and Joey's family. She told her mom that no one would take her. Ultimately, her aunt came by and took Jennifer and the baby to the hospital. They were kept there overnight while tests were run. Before they were released, the treating physician told Jennifer and her aunt that it appeared that Adriana had an infection usually only seen in sexually active adult female patients. Her aunt returned her and the baby back to Joey's house. Jennifer called her mom and told her about the ER visit, and Kathy encouraged her to take her to a follow-up appointment with the pediatrician. Jennifer agreed, and later that day, her grandmother took her to the appointment. The pediatrician said the rash and infection could be related to being in a wet diaper for an extended period of time.
After Jennifer was back at Joey's home, she called Kathy and asked her to make what is known as butt butter for the rash. Kathy agreed. Kathy met Joey, Jennifer, and Adriana in the parking lot of a local pharmacy that evening. According to Kathy, Adriana didn't look good, and she wanted to go with her grandmother. Kathy told her that maybe they could see each other that weekend. She buckled her in the car seat and said goodbye to her daughter and granddaughter. Kathy didn't hear from Jennifer until the following evening. Around 9 p.m., Jennifer called. She was upset. She told her mom that Joey's mom was yelling at her because Adriana wouldn't quit crying, and her son was acting like a dad to a child that wasn't his. Kathy could hear yelling and Adriana crying. She asked Jennifer where the baby was. Jennifer said they were trying to sleep train her, so Joey was in her room with her. Jennifer said she couldn't stand to hear her child cry, which is why Joey was better suited to sleep training. Kathy told Jennifer that with Adriana not feeling well, it was not the night for sleep training. Jennifer went and got the baby with her mom still on the phone. Kathy said Jennifer told her Adriana immediately laid down on her and fell asleep. She told her daughter everything would be better in the morning after they got some sleep. But Jennifer didn't call Kathy the next day. She did talk to family members that day, though. Casey told us about those phone calls.
Jennifer actually calls and talks to my aunt, Lisa, that had taken her, you know, earlier that week to the ER on Monday. She calls her and talks to her, tells her all about the fighting that's going on, you know, and my aunt is like, I'm going to leave a key out for you. So if you want to come here, if things get bad and you want to come here, like she lives right down the road. And my sister's like, okay, you know. And so she had that phone conversation, and I don't know exact times because I don't have records and everything, but I do have some of these like old topics forums. And then she talked to her dad after that. And her dad lived in Manchester, Tennessee. So that's like, you know, an hour and a half south of Nashville. And she was supposed to, according to this phone call, go and see him that weekend. Like, you know, she was like, I'll come see you. And so she talked to her dad, told him all of the same things about the doctor appointments that the baby had had, about the fighting and everything that had gone on. And she tells her dad, and she says, I'm scared, Dad. And he's like, of what? And she says, of Joey's mom. Like, she's being very mean to me today. Like, you know, she's just not acting normal. She's acting crazy. And he's like, well, why don't you have your granny or your mom or someone come get you? And she says, no, Joey will be home in a little bit. We're going to go on a picnic. And so on this phone call, reading through these forums and her dad's statement is that he heard cartoons on the TV playing in the background.
Jennifer's phone call with her dad is the last time anyone spoke to her other than those in the Benton household. Joey had been working construction that week with Jennifer's cousin in Franklin County, Kentucky. The two had been carpooling because Joey's truck was in the shop. On Thursday, March 25th, while on the job, Joey received a phone call. According to reports, he told his supervisor he had to leave for a family emergency. Jennifer's cousin drove him home sometime after noon. The rest of the timeline before Jennifer and Adriana's disappearance is as reported by Joey Benton's statement to the family and also to the police. And his statement changed with additional details over many different conversations. But ultimately, this was Joey's account beginning on Thursday, March 24th. This is what he says. Around 9 p.m., he took Jennifer and Adriana to the Food Value in Cross Plains. He said Jennifer went inside to use the phone since she didn't have her own. When she returned to the car, she asked him to take her to the Exxon at exit 112 on Interstate I-65. Joey said they waited 10 minutes for another car to arrive. He described the car as an older, four-door, white vehicle. According to what he told Kathy, the car pulled up next to them. Jennifer and Adriana got out and entered the back seat of the other car. He couldn't tell how many people were in the car or who they were. Joey said he saw Jennifer one other time the following day. On Friday, the 26th, Joey rode to work with Jennifer's cousin again. But when another co-worker's girlfriend arrived to pick him up after a half day's work, he rode back to Robertson County with them. This is what Casey learned about that drive.
So I'm not sure why my cousin didn't drive him home, but there's another friend who was working with them who drove him home that day because his girlfriend came to pick him up early, he says. And Joey asked them for a ride home. And they say that he was acting really super suspicious on the way home, that he was like acting weird. They said he was always kind of weird, but this particular day he was acting very strange. And the girl, the girlfriend of this friend who drove him home, she was actually driving. And she says that she was terrified. She just wanted him out of the car. So this is, you know, these are statements coming from our investigation and talking to these people over time.
Once home, Joey said Jennifer came by the house without Adriana. She asked him for her tax refund money. Jennifer didn't have a bank account, so her refund had been deposited in the family checking account. Joey told Jennifer she'd have to come back because his parents were at home to give her the money. Meanwhile, Jennifer had not contacted any of her family since her midday phone call with her dad on Thursday the 25th. By Friday night, Kathy was sure something was wrong. Jennifer never went 24 hours without talking to at least one family member, her mom, aunt, grandmothers, someone. She goes out to look for her. There is no sign. The next morning, she reports her missing to the Robertson County Sheriff's Office. Initially, the case was treated as if Jennifer left with her child on her own accord.
And, you know, right at the very top, it is a mother saying that she's afraid that her daughter and her granddaughter are in danger because of her daughter's boyfriend, Mr. Benton. Now, you know, as we sort of are going through this and looking at all the different details, and we're going to pick apart sort of details, you know, let's look at this now. We've got a reportedly violent relationship history, and we have them potentially living in a home with guns and drugs. According to Casey, it was weed, cocaine. And we've got no family seeing or speaking to Jennifer after Thursday midday. When it comes down to the boyfriend, there's an interesting thing that he does here where he says she gets into a car. And usually that would be the last of it. That would be, oh, she got into a car, because we've heard these stories before of, I dropped my girlfriend off and then she got into another car. Mm. You know, there's a case that I'm working in Middletown, Ohio, where a guy says that, yep, I dropped my my girlfriend off and she got into a Dodge Durango at this corner. And they, you know, they checked all the surveillance footage and could never find somebody getting into a Dodge Durango at that time. But he throws a curveball by saying that he sees her again afterwards.
Right.
What do you think is going on here?
Well, you know, it's really tough to discern. Everything is coming from Joey at this point. And this is where follow up, you know, on the missing persons report, you get the assigned investigator. Okay, you're now trying to corroborate what he is saying. You know, he's saying that her and the daughter went to Food Value in Cross Plains. You go to Food Value. Do you have any surveillance? Do you have any transactions that support that statement? And then you have the Exxon. You know, does Exxon have surveillance to support that Jennifer actually was there? You know, so now it's you're having to try to assess the truthfulness of what the boyfriend is saying, because he's the one that is relating, you know, the last moments that Jennifer and Adriana were seen.
Yeah. And if you take a look at the report, you know, they took the deputy took statements from Jennifer's mother, sister, aunt and grandmother, and all stated that he had made threats that he was going to kill Jennifer and the baby and that no one would find them. That's a quote.
Yeah.
So obviously, because you had four people coming in and saying these things, it seems to me that they were taking this more serious than just a missing person. So, you know, you hope they were. And we're going to get into, you know, how they dug into some of the more details.
Well, and the way that I'm seeing that they're taking it more seriously is that there is an investigator that is being consulted. You know, this isn't just a deputy taking the police report and, you know, getting things done on that side. You know, there is some consultation with an investigator and the investigator is weighing in. You know, law enforcement does try to verify the drop at the Exxon with the surveillance footage, but the gas station recorded over the footage. Please, guys, you know, let's
seriously.
Yes.
Come on.
So there was no footage to view. Jennifer's mom, Kathy, went the next step and spoke to the woman who was working during this time. This is what Casey told us about her mom's conversation.
My mom actually spoke to the girl, the gas station attendant at that Exxon, who was working that night. And that girl knew Jennifer very well and went to school with her. And the girl said, like, no, I was up front all night long. You know, there are glass windows on the front, like they have advertisements and things, but there's nothing blocking them. And she said, I would have seen her. Jennifer would have come inside. She would have been like, hey, but she didn't. She was like, I did not see her here.
Then Jennifer's family and law enforcement tried to verify the phone call made at the Food Value before the supposed Exxon drop-off. The cashier said they locked the doors at 9 p.m. The employee also said she had to run back into the store to grab some soda she left inside. At no point did she see Jennifer, the baby, or Joey. The manager of the store was also interviewed. He told Jennifer's aunt that there were two phones she could have placed a call from inside the store. But the manager told her aunt that no one came inside to use the phone that night. Finally, the bagger at the store was also interviewed. He did not see Jennifer either. So we have both places that should have witnesses don't. But, you know, listen, just because they didn't see her, she certainly could have been there. They could have looked down or whatever. But That is a red flag, or those are red flags. Law enforcement attempted to do a welfare check on Jennifer and Adriana at the Benton residence. And when they arrived, Joey was home alone. And guess what? He wouldn't allow officers to enter. His parents weren't home, and Joey told the officer he would need a warrant to enter their home. They returned the next day. The officer noted he didn't see any guns, despite being told they were present. But this was a welfare check, remember, not a search.
A welfare check. They're walking through the home, see if Jennifer and Adriana is there. They're not. This is whenever they take the statement with the white Ford car, Mustang Camaro thing. They take the statement, you know, they do a walkthrough, they don't find them, you know, then it's kind of like just on us at that point, you know.
Did they note anything suspicious in the house, or just they just know they weren't there?
They just know they weren't there. And again, it was kind of like a welfare check. It wasn't like they were looking for something suspicious, because at this point, her boyfriend's sitting there saying, I dropped her off at a gas station yesterday, you know, or whenever, not yesterday, but Thursday. So they wouldn't think anything suspicious yet. They're just thinking, well, she ran off. You know, that's how it was treated for a really long time. Like, she ran off. She was a runaway with her baby. Which is just absurd. Like, there are a lot of things leading up to this day that, and then a ton of inconsistent stories after the fact that just don't add up.
Now, does it raise your radar when an occupant requires a warrant for a welfare check?
Well, of course it does, but it's oftentimes that occupants, you know, Fourth Amendment right to require that. This is where this is a bit of a gray area legally, and is highly contested. And I'm sure there's going to be some legal minds out there that, you know, have, you know, great insight. But, you know, this deputy, you know, a welfare check, you know, you can do a warrantless search with a welfare check or a wellness check. But you need to have an exigency or an imminent threat. And, you know, like in this situation, at least with the information that this deputy had going there, he doesn't necessarily have that, you know. So now the deputy is required to rely on his senses, his observations. You know, if he, you know, knocks on the door and Joey answers it and he's hearing somebody whimpering in the background, doesn't matter if what Joey wants at that point. Now the deputy is going, there is a problem. There's an exigency. If Joey has blood all over him, there's a problem here. You know, now the deputy can push past Joey, who's requesting a warrant. However, absent any of those, you know, those facts, you know, that deputy is now just going, okay, you know, with the information I have, this guy wants a warrant, and, you know, the home is the castle from a Fourth Amendment standpoint for, you know, citizens in the United States. So this is where the deputy presumably made the right decision. It's just that what happened from the time that deputy left to the time they went back to take a look. The case remained a missing persons file until 2013. At that time, Bill Holt was elected as the new sheriff of Robertson County. He vowed to solve Jennifer's case and reclassified it as a homicide. He also brought in the TBI for help. At a press conference, Sheriff Holt said, "We've developed some new information in the past several weeks that brings us to the conclusion that there was foul play involved." He didn't elaborate on what this new information was. Holt also made certain to say no one had been eliminated as a suspect in the case. According to law enforcement, they had searched the Benton property four times at this point. The searches included draining a pond. Joey's grandmother told the Tennessean that the last time law enforcement asked to search, the family said no. She also added, "I don't think they ever had another suspect other than Joey. I'm sorry she went missing. Don't get me wrong. We loved that little girl. She would come up to the house and eat supper with us. So when they asked us, we let them search. We never refused, but she's not on our property. We don't know nothing about it."
So, Paul, why reclassify the case? And also, what evidence or what statements do you need in order to reclassify a case?
Well, you know, the way that law enforcement is going to classify this case or any case is going to be based on the facts that they have. Now, those facts may be objective facts, such as, you know, you have an obvious dead body. You have evidence of violence, let's say a lot of bloodshed at a particular location. Even though you don't have a body, you're going, you know, this appears that this person was probably killed. Now, in this case, with missing persons, you know, part of what is going on is that you have the passage of time without Jennifer or Adriana, you know, coming up somewhere else. But they probably have something more than just the passage of time to take it from the missing persons case based on these circumstances where, you know, Joey saying, well, he dropped them off at the Exxon. To now they're going, okay, we think foul play was involved. I think they found something that they're now digging into.
So again, there wasn't much movement on this case until this year. That's when Casey said one of Joey's relatives reached out to her.
And so we were invited by them. They reached out to me on Facebook and said, you know, hey, we're having this family issue. Like, do you want to come and search? And of course we're like, heck yeah. We put it together in, I would say, under 2 weeks. We had search teams come out here from the Q Center, cadaver dogs and, you know, a lot of different, like, dogs and their masters come out. And we searched, like, 50 acres or so. And the dogs wear, like, GPS collars and whatnot, you know, so we can see what all areas they searched. And yeah, that search, again, I can't share the results from that. I can say that I will have something to share from that soon, but I can't say what that is yet. But that was kind of what prompted me to get started in all of this, because I'm like, whoa, like, we haven't had a relationship with them in 17 years, anyone in his family. We've always kind of just been against each other, you know? And then I'm like, now they're reaching out to us, like, out of nowhere, just inviting us to come and search. And of course, we're going to take advantage of it. But also, there's this kind of relationship now. And it's very odd. And it's very, I mean, I'm extremely thankful for them for letting us come and do this, because they're not Joey and his mom and dad. You know, they're other family members. And so I guess I'm like just really thankful. But that's kind of what prompted it all.
Now, Paul, you often talk about sometimes you have to wait for relationships to potentially deteriorate mm-hmm. to solve one of these cases, because then somebody is willing to talk. This could be something like that, because, you know, you have somebody from the family inviting them to come out and do a search.
Yeah. You know, and this is the benefit of the passage of time. Obviously, passage of time could be detrimental to a case, detrimental to evidence. But also on cold cases, you know, which is what I really focused in on in my career, that passage of time does cause relationships to change. And here, that's what we're seeing. Now you have somebody within the prime suspect's family inviting the potential victim's family in to do a search.
Now, Casey did tell us that something was discovered, but she's not comfortable saying what it is, at least publicly. So, you know, after 17 years, what are some of the things that could be found if we to hypothesize, you know, and we certainly saw this with the Kristen Smart case recently, where this was a missing persons case. And then, you know, we had action on it this year.
You know, I think first and foremost would be partial remains. You know, maybe they found some bones and now they're testing the bones, you know, first to determine, are they human? And then secondly, are they from Jennifer and or Adriana? But there could be other things. There could be clothing fragments. You know, do these clothing fragments have, you know, DNA, have blood staining on them? Even after 17 years, there could be that potential. And if that comes back that way, then yes, you know, then you have something in which you can hang your hat on, that it's possible that, like in Kristen Smart's case, we possibly had, you know, a body here. We have some victims of foul play.
So Casey and her family not only put the search together, but Casey has gone into full investigative mode. She's taken upon herself to revisit all of her mom's notes from early on. And those notes included conversations her mom had and some of the posts on an old topics forum supposedly made by Joey's family. And we have some of these posts from these topics forums about that are supposedly from Joey's family, talking about how somebody made an appointment for her with a shrink, as they call it, pointing out her mental illness, saying that she was diagnosed with bipolar and had started taking new meds, which, but that doesn't mean that she broke all patterns and talked to no family members, you know. You know, one of the other things that's there is that, and it's strange to have these conversations on in a public forum, but it does seem like these were coming from the family. So Joey's dad also talks about that there was a mystery woman in his home Thursday with Jennifer. So you've got Joey talking about this mystery car, this four-door car, which at first he says is a Camaro. Then he says it's a Mustang. And then he says it's a four-door. You know, it's all over the place. Mm-hmm. And now you've got this mystery woman in the home on Thursday with Jennifer. There's also some things about Jennifer saying Jennifer made up the story about the abuse and how the charges were dropped. You know, there's just a lot of trying to blame Kathy, actually, for Jennifer's disappearance.
Well, you know, this is now, what, 5 years after Jennifer and Adriana have gone missing. The families have taken, you know, things into an online forum. You know, there's no jeopardy on anybody in terms of being factually accurate and in terms of what they're putting out there. And so you always have to take these types of online statements with a grain of salt. You know, what is the primary motivation for the person that's posting these statements? And usually it's self-preservation, right? You know, so, you know, maybe there's some factual aspects in here, but this is just something that the investigators, you know, they're going to compile all this. You know, if they're savvy enough, they're grabbing all of these statements. And if they ever get to a point to where they're conducting interviews and now talking to a peace officer where, you know, you do have some jeopardy in terms of what your freedom is going to be if you're not telling the truth. You know, why are you telling me one thing when you said this over here? You know, that's something that you'll be able to confront the person you're talking to with this type of information. It's actually a gold mine, even though you can't rely on any of it. It's a gold mine for the investigation because you can see the stances and the information that they're trying to put out there. And if it's wrong, why are they doing that? It gives you insight into their motivation.
Yeah, Casey also talks about they had posted things about how Jennifer made 27 calls to different phones. None of them could be traced. You know, just setting up a lot of potential smoke.
Mm-hmm.
And Casey also said that she's talking to people who have never spoken before about this, including Jennifer's cousin.
I've been talking to, you know, people that investigators won't really talk to or can't talk to, just because, you know, police and law enforcement can come off scary sometimes. But like me, I'm just approaching it like I'm just trying to find out what happened to my sister. Like I'm not even going to tell anyone that we talked, you know, kind of thing. And so that's whenever the first person I talked to was my cousin, Jeffrey. You know, and I told you I hadn't talked to him since, you know, it's been years, 15 years probably. And, you know, that was a hard conversation to have, you know, hearing him say how regretful he was of not doing more then, you know, he was such a young kid. That was his friend. He didn't want to believe, you know, that his friend was capable of something like that. And he wishes he would have, you know, asked more questions and paid attention more. And, you know, it's sad to hear that and what it's done to our family. So that was my first conversation. I've talked to just everyone I can think of that was involved at any point in time, people that hung out there before and after they went missing, just trying to nail down the timeline, you know, and what happened. And you know, I've talked to a couple of those people already, and I have to make it where it's not hearsay, you know, because if you talk to the police on this case, they'll tell you there's a lot of rumors. There's a lot of she was under the concrete. There's a cemetery right next door to their house. So there's a lot of rumors about them being in one of those graves. So in the concrete, there's even a rumor about pigs eating them. Like there's like all kinds of crazy rumors. So if you ask police about it, that's what they're going to say. They're going to say, oh, that's hearsay.
You know, this is, you know, what Casey's doing is what you have to do. You know, there's so much, especially in a higher profile case or cases that move into the online realm, in which now rumors run rampant and the street rumors run rampant. And so when information starts coming in, the investigators have to verify that information. And sometimes you can verify it right away because you know the facts of the case, and you can say, yeah, this statement is completely wrong up front in terms of what I know about the case. But other times you have new leads that come in, and is this bona fide, or is this because of this rumor mill that's out there? So you have to do this fact checking in order to make sure that it's something that you need to put resources on to try to figure out, is it the right direction the investigation needs to go?
Yeah.
Now, Casey's also trying to get access to her niece's medical records from the ER and the pediatrician before they went missing. It's a large part of her focus right now. We also asked Casey about Adriana's father, wanting to investigate all avenues. At the time of Jennifer and Adriana's disappearance, a paternity test was in process. Her father was unknown. The man wasn't notified of paternity until after Jennifer and Adriana disappeared.
So what do you think should happen here now? You know, what avenues beyond Joey do you think should be looked at?
You know, there's two primary theories. You know, the boyfriend is a prime suspect because of the past relationship history and some of his behaviors when contacted by law enforcement. But then we also have to consider the possibility, did Jennifer and Adriana, you know, did Jennifer, you know, voluntarily disappear? You know, she's scared of the relationship and she's deciding, you know, for my own safety, I need to get out of here. However, there has to be consideration. Let's say Joey's telling the truth. He dropped her off at Exxon. Did Jennifer and Adriana run across somebody else and met with foul play? So taking a look at those various scenarios is what has to happen. You always keep everything open, but you also have to take a look at the facts of the case and where the most reward is going to come in terms of pursuing leads. And right now, you know, the most likely scenario based on the facts is that somebody very close to Jennifer and Adriana, i.e. Joey, has something to do with their disappearance.
And also, you know, we've got Joey and the Bentons overall. They've been very standoffish. I think this kind of split potentially in the Bentons could certainly help, and at times certainly could help. And we just have to wait for what they found and see what they are able to come back with. And Casey has also recently had meetings with the sheriff. You know, we want to thank Casey for coming on the show, and we hope to be able to push this forward and get answers. That's going to take us to our weekly assignment. You know, 21-year-old Jennifer Wicks's family last spoke to her on Thursday, March 25th, 2004, sometime in the afternoon. Based on the additional lack of witnesses, it's unknown what her movements were after that. She may have been at the Exxon off of exit 112 on Interstate I-65 in Cross Plains, Tennessee, with her 2-year-old daughter, Adriana. At the time of her disappearance, Jennifer was 5'4 to 5'6, 125 to 135 pounds, brown eyes, brown hair with red highlights. She wears glasses with silver oval wire frames, has a tribal tattoo on her lower back, and her ears were pierced twice. 2-year-old Adriana has brown hair and blue-green eyes and a birthmark on the front of her upper right thigh. She also went by the nickname Nina. If you have any information, please contact us or the Robertson County Sheriff's Office. You know the rules. You know, don't name names in public. Don't make accusations, of course, as well, to these people's names. No side-by-sides. Be nice to each other. Don't dox each other. And that takes us to the weekly distraction. Paul, what are you being distracted by this week?
Well, I'm going to say what I'm being distracted by right now. And that's, you know, I just went in, you know, for a dental appointment. I just had a cleaning done. And, you know, I can always tell when it's been about 6 months since I've had my teeth cleaned. I mean, I can feel it, right? The teeth feel kind of grimy. I love the feeling of coming out of the dental office, yeah. and it's just like the teeth are smooth, all the plaque has been removed. It's like, this is, you got the fresh mouth, right? I know this is kind of a goofy thing, but right now I'm like constantly licking my teeth going, wow, they feel good. So,
you know, I actually just got my teeth cleaned 2 days ago, and the hygienist was explaining to me the difference between plaque and tartar. Which she also called calculus, I believe it is.
Okay.
And how it's like a sandy-like substance. So then she was showing me, because I'm into that kind of stuff. So then she would take out like the calculus stuff. And it's like, see how that's like, I was like, yeah, that's really gross that was in my mouth. But I completely understand what you're talking about.
Yeah, maybe TMI, but okay.
Yeah, maybe a little bit too TMI, but you know what?
Everybody deals with it. Everybody has to deal with it, right?
Yes. So here's what I am distracted by. So a lot of times, and we love the members of the Murder Squad, we love getting stuff that y'all send to us. It's great. Now, a lot of people do send us bottles of certain spirits, which is wonderful. Now, this one of our listeners works as a distributor for Broken Shed Vodka, which is a vodka from New Zealand. I'm a fan of New Zealand. I was like, send us, right? He sent me and you two cases. So I've got 12 bottles of this vodka at my house right now.
Oh my
now.
God.
one is for you and one's for me. I'm not going to send it to you though. So you've got to come here so we can
finish off a case of vodka.
Party for listeners.
Or
two cases. There's 12 bottles of Broken Shed vodka. It's good vodka. You know, I will say that right now. But yeah, no. So, Jesus. Somebody also sent me, what were those? It's great because we have so many listeners that are on the road a lot, and that, you know, I think they like, you know, having something to do. Somebody sent us an entire box of Zapp's New Orleans kettle style potato chips.
Oh,
because they listen to us while we're driving. Yeah. So yeah. I've got those and I'm keeping them in my car just so I'm not tempted to eat them at, you know, at night and things like that. So
you're just eating them while you're driving. You're distracted.
Basically,
driver.
Yeah. Pretty much. I'm certainly not distracted. But believe me, it's just, that was one of the things that would happen too. And Paul, you will find this when you go on your book tour. By the way, Paul's book comes out April 26th. That people will come up to you with a bottle, which is wonderful, but then you're flying the next day because our book tours are frantic, and you're just like, what do I do with this bottle? And then you're kind of in your hotel room alone with a bottle at the end of the night.
That wouldn't be.
You can't bring it on the plane.
I've been there where, yeah, I have a bottle of bourbon in my hotel room. It's only, you know, half empty, and it's like, there's just no way, you know.
Yeah, and then what do you give it to the guy at the front desk?
You know, I leave it for, you know, if, you know, the house, you know, the cleaning lady comes in, she can have it. You know, it's just.
All right. Well, that's it for us for this week. Everyone, please go rate, review, and subscribe. Merch. We've got some holiday merch, which are actually rocks glasses, whiskey glasses. Very cool. Appropriate. The Murder Squad rocks glasses.
So if you want some Murder Squad merch, guess what?
If you order on Cyber Monday, 11/29, that's free standard shipping for all Podswag orders. And then December 8th, that's the last day you can order with standard shipping for delivery by Christmas Eve. Follow us on social media, and until next week, keep digging.
And don't be an irony. Jensen and Holes, The Murder Squad, is produced by Exactly Right Media and Bench Clearing Productions. Senior producer, Paulie Katowski. Associate producer, Haley Gray. Engineer, Stephen Ray Morris. Music, Tom Breifogel. Executive producers, Karen Kilgara, Georgia Hardstark, Danielle Kramer.